Okay, hi everyone. Adam contacted me a little while ago and asked me if I wanted to do a talk, and kind of leapt at it really. And the reason was that a few months ago on Discord, here in our Friday night chat, somebody issued a challenge. I'm feeling it was Paddy, but that's as far as my memory goes. Apologies, Paddy, if it wasn't you. Somebody issued a challenge that we present more positive accounts of socialism. Not that we don't present positive accounts of socialism, but the feeling was we should do more of it. And we should sort of balance the more negative case that we make against capitalism with more positive articles, etc. I wanted to take up that challenge for a number of reasons, which I think will become clear in the course of what I'm going to say. But when I started to kind of think about what I wanted to say, I was going to give some examples of the kinds of thinking that I thought was implicit in this challenge that was made. And but actually, the more I thought about it, the more I realized we're mostly party members here. And I'd kind of be spending my time teaching Granny to suck eggs, really, because I wouldn't be saying anything that was particularly exceptional in any way. Quite late on last night, I decided that instead I would just talk a little bit about some issues that have been going on for me over this question for a number of years. So it's going to be more of a kind of personal view rather than a sort of stand up SBGB talk here who are not party members if they were hoping for something else. I'm sure there will be that kind of discussion in the discussion period afterwards. We can talk about how we can speculate about socialism, but I wanted really to talk about speculation itself and how I feel about the importance of giving a positive case for socialism, giving a positive case for socialism as an achieved end, as an achieved post-capitalist society. And I'm going to start off by putting something completely aside. And I'm going to put it in a box, and I'm going to close the lid, and I'm going to put it on my shelf, and I'm going to take down another box on the other side called libertarianism, anarcho-capitalism, and I think you'll understand why in a few minutes. I don't know how most of you feel about anarcho-capitalism. I'm presuming that most of you think about it in more or less the same way that I do, that it's an unrealizable fantasy. It's an absurdity. And certainly I think that's the case. But I'd like to propose to you something else. I'd like to propose that anarcho-capitalism has a lot going for it. And I don't mean in terms of the rationality of its case. I mean as a propaganda vehicle, as a way of getting a message out, a way of valorizing capitalism. And if we look at it, let's have a look at where it is, what it says, the basic message. It says, look, we've got capitalism here, yeah? We've got capitalism, and this is the greatest society that ever existed on the planet because it can produce so much. It can produce more than any other kind of society that's ever existed. It's created huge amounts of wealth. And not only that, it's actually relieving poverty faster than any other system of society has ever done in the past. The World Bank tells us this, and who better to tell us, give us this, And, well, it's kind of not capitalism, is it? It's kind of crony capital, but it's kind of capitalism. It's kind of yeah, it isn't it? Because it's kind of got a glitch, and the glitch is something called government. And the problem with government is that it interferes with the free market. It upsets the free market and prevents it producing all these wonderful goodies that we know it's capable of as a result of the invisible hand. So what we've got to do is we've got to get rid of government. That's what we need to do. Basically the case. That's basically the anarcho-capitalist case. Once we get rid of government, will be wonderful, and then we can all get down to working hard and making lots of money. Now, as absurd as we may think that this claim is, it's really positive. Just think about it. You know, it's no wonder so many people are actually going for it, particularly young people. It's got all those features that are going to sort of stimulate excitement and the imagination. But it's got something else as well, which I think we shouldn't neglect. It's also relatively risk-free. Yeah? We know capitalism. Whatever we think about it, we're familiar with it. Yeah? We know government. All we've got to do is vote out government. Simple as that. Just going to vote out government or vote minimum government so that we can allow the market to do its job. And once we actually get rid of government, then we don't have to do anything. Capitalism will do it all for us. So it's all risk-free. We don't actually have to take any risks. We don't have to make any serious changes. It's going to be easy. I think that's the power of anarcho-capitalism in terms of its appeal, particularly to younger people, but also to many older people as well. So we put it away back in its box and we pick out the socialism box. We open the socialism box and we compare it as a propaganda message. I don't know about you, but I think the socialist case looks a bit like a limp lettuce leaf in comparison for a number of reasons. It's a complicated case. It's difficult to put across. It's not this simple message which the anarcho-capitalists have. It's complicated. Fundamentally, what are we asking them to do? We're asking them to take a leap into the unknown with socialism. Yeah. And that's scaring for people. We're asking them to abandon everything that they know and are familiar with and have built their security around. Now, we know that capitalism is not secure for the working class, but at least it's familiar and people cling to things that are familiar. And we're also asking them to give up things they value because, like it or not, people do have things about capitalism that they value, that they like, or that they feel that they like. Now, we could compare values of capitalism with socialism and we could point out that maybe, you know, socialists actually appeal to them more once they got used to them and that sort of thing. But fundamentally, there are things that people like about capitalism and they tell us so. So we're asking them to give all that up and we're asking them basically to face their real fears about the future. So we're asking them to face their fears. It's not an easy thing. In comparison with the anarcho-capitalist case, the socialist case is really a hard nut to crack. We've got a hard, and it shows in terms of the response that we get. So what do we do to help people face those fears? Well, we have a negative case and a positive case. If we put the negative case to people, it's not hard to put the negative case. Capitalism gives us a lot of material, of meat to feed on. Every day, there is something that's going on in the world, in the capitalist world around us, which actually shows that it's a system that cannot meet human need. It cannot meet the requirements of the working class. It does not meet their interests. On the other hand, we find it difficult to talk about socialism because we have less to go on. It's a theoretical construct. We don't have the information there, so we don't talk about it so much. So we spend a lot of time making the negative case, and we show people how destructive it is to their lives. Now, if you're talking to people, what's the best case scenario in terms of their response? The best case scenario is that they agree with us. It often happens that people do. I mean, people are actually quite cynical these days, and they do agree with us over a lot of things. And you get to the end of your spiel, and you say, okay, what do you think? And they said, absolutely fantastic. I agree with everything you say, but it's not going to work. And then they start making excuses, and they say, well, yeah, but, you know, there's human nature. You know, you're not going to change people. You know, you think people are going to be different in this future society, but you're not really going to change them. People are greedy. People want status. They want power. You know, the poor have always been with us, you know. And we're an aggressive species, you know, there have always been. What makes you think that there aren't going to be wars in the future? And they go on and they make a whole load of excuses. And I often wonder when I hear this, what they're making excuses for. Because on the surface, it sounds like they're making excuses for capitalism. But after they've just agreed with you how absolutely horrendous capitalism can be, it seems rather strange to me that they should then leap into making excuses for it. See, I think they're making excuses for themselves. I think that they're making excuses because they don't actually want to even face the reality of the world in which they live. Now, as socialists, we're asking people to take a mighty leap, to let go of things that they cling to for security. And we know that people do that. As horrendous as things can sometimes be, we know that people cling to it. They cling to capitalism. In order to give them the courage to let go, we have to offer them something else. We have to offer them a positive message. You know, people don't let go of stuff until you can offer them something that they can put in its place and that they can value. So basically, what are we offering? Well, we're offering a theory. We're offering fundamentally other things as well, but fundamentally we're offering a theory. We're offering a theory of history. We all know how it goes. All of history of proprietarian societies is the history of class war. And when the working class eventually dispossess the capitalist class, there will be no classes left, so there'll be no need for government. Everyone will have the same relation to the means of production, so there'll be no need for private property, no buying and selling, and therefore no money. But because socialism can't exist in an enclave within a capitalist world, it will have to be global. So we're left with this kind of very familiar letter that socialism is a classless, moneyless, stateless, global society with free access, which is fine. But they want to know, okay, that's your theory, but how will it work? Now, we can respond to this in various ways. I mean, we can take the kind of classic Marxian line and say, well, you know, we can't really offer recipes for future cookshops. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever tried that. In my naive youth, when I was first a socialist, I did actually use that on occasion. And you get a very, very back and, you know, a come off it. As a propaganda process, that really doesn't work. You know, you're trying to sell me this and you don't even know. You know, of course, you can give rational arguments for it. It's a perfectly rational position to say we can't offer recipes for future cook shops, but it's not actually going to win any people over. So you say, okay, well, you know, we can't offer these recipes, but we can speculate. And so we go back and we start speculating about the various things, the various ways in which capitalism might organize itself. And they'll listen for a bit. And then you say, well, what do you think? And they say, well, it all sounds very nice, but it's totally utopian, isn't it? I mean, it's pure fantasy. It'll never actually work. So it's that kind of, the kind of speculation that we actually provide to people when we do it often doesn't work. And I think we need to look at that and and ask, why doesn't it work? Are we actually offering the right things to people? Of course, they might, you know, if you don't lose them at that point, they might go on and ask, well, what are you going to do about lack of incentive? You know, answer the economic calculation argument if they're a bit clued up on things and they've read their Mises and Hayek. You know, how are you going to stop greedy people taking more than their share? What's all this about voting? You know, are you going to spend your entire life voting over every single thing? How are you going to deal with minority or corruption or greed for power? How are you going to deal with all these questions? And we have answers for them, and we give those answers. And they're reasonable concerns, and we have reasonable answers for them. But they're kind of general answers, and they don't go very far. And I've often wondered why these don't seem very often convincing to people. And it's not hard to find, because I actually find that they're often not particularly convincing to me. Now, I have to say I'm a lifelong moderate skeptic, you know, which is basically what every scientist is. And I believe that every claim, every statement, every hypothesis or theory needs to be subjected to ruthless cross-examination, ruthless criticism. And when I do that to these arguments, they don't seem quite to fit to do the job. And I could never quite work out why until I think quite. And I want, really, part of what I want to do this evening is to just give you an idea of why I think that they don't, and what we might need to do to improve on what we've got. And if the idea appeals to you, then run with it. If it doesn't, then shoot me down. That's absolutely fine. I'm quite happy for you to do that. You know, it's the discussion that's important. It's the thrashing out of the ideas. People then come back and they dismiss our arguments. And ultimately, there is just this one intoned response. This won't work, mate. So I have to ask myself, well, how do I? No one has a crystal ball. No human being has a crystal ball. No socialist has a crystal ball. None of us can be absolutely certain of the outcome of our actions in the future. We're getting closer in certain scientific disciplines to being able to predict the future. But we can't do it for complex systems like societies. They're just too damn complicated. So no one has a crystal ball. So how do we actually know? I wonder how many people here can really put their hand on their hearts and say, I can guarantee that socialism will work as we conceive it. Because I know I can't. And we can't actually offer that to people. What we can do is we can offer justifications for believing that it will work. And we can offer reasoned argument, and we can offer evidence. Both are important. But we can't offer any guarantees. So we're asking people to take a risk and to take a leap into the future. So any positive claims that we have to, that we can make, have to be as strong and as concrete as possible. And that's where I've been thinking about things a lot recently. How can we provide more convincing arguments? Because the fact is, they're not convincing to a lot of people. If they were convincing, our membership would be much higher than ours. We wouldn't just have 300 members, or even less probably now, a lot less. But we need to think about this. Are our arguments convincing? And if they're not, why are they not? And what can we do about it? You know, I think if you look back at Marx, in Marx's time, Marx and Engels, in my view, then you were Enlightenment humanists. they were living and writing in an atmosphere, post-Enlightenment atmosphere, but still very much strongly influenced by the Enlightenment, in which one of the unspoken guiding beliefs was a belief in human progress. They were writing in this milieu. They died in the First World War, you know. After the First World War, you know, you couldn't take it for granted that people would just simply accept the arguments that we were presenting. And if, but, you know, even in the 70s, when I first joined, 1970s, when I first joined the party, you know, you could go to a debate and we could sway the audience with the moral argument. You know, people would still want to know who was going to do the dirty work. You know, there would still be practical issues, but the moral argument actually carried more power than it does, I think, these days. Now, I may be wrong about that. That's just my impression. But I think we live in a much more cynical world now, you know, and we live in a much more well-informed world. We live in the world of the internet. We live in the world of Wikipedia. So we need to make our arguments more robust. At least I feel that we do. So if we review what we offer to people to get them to let go of clinging to capitalism, I think we offer three things. We offer a theory of history, which I've already mentioned. We offer a moral, or more strictly speaking, a case for working class interests. And we offer a number of attractive speculative scenarios, attractive to some, not to others. And that's what we've got. And I just wonder in my head what that actually adds up to. And it occurred to me just quite recently, and I'm just putting this forward as a kind of hypothesis. When I think back about the party arguments that don't quite convince me, it occurs to me that the reason they don't convince me is that we always assume best case scenarios. We're so keen to convince people of the socialist case that we want to put the best possible light upon it. And we don't actually think about what would we do if things went wrong? How would we respond to things going wrong? Because if we think about things going wrong, we are going to be forced to think more strategically about them. We're going to have to think, okay, well, if that goes, you know, if we don't assume, you know, come the revolution, everything is going on perfectly to order. There are no glitches anywhere. Then we can say, yes, this will happen. And we can give examples of, or we can give arguments for how what we propose will work. I think that actually contributes to people's perception of us as utopian. Not really hard-headed enough in our arguments over this, I think. I don't want to go into a lot of examples, but I was talking to an anarchist the other day, and he was coming up with the usual anarchist concerns about the use of parliament. You know, what about, you know, those people you send to parliament suddenly deciding that they want to, that they get a taste for power and they want to start controlling what goes on. And we would have an argument for that. We would say, well, there'd be delegates, so we, you know, they are recallable delegates. But hey, you know, let's think of a scenario like this. The army is not on board with the revolution, even if the people have voted a shedload of delegates to parliament. The army's not on board. And starting to try and take over the workplaces, there's been fighting and violence and shooting and confusion, and lines of communication with delegates are not easy, or they are slow. The whole democratic process is slow in terms of what how we want them to act. And suppose they actually feel that they need to act quickly and take quick decisions in order to salvage the situation. And there's the army, you know, and the army and the military, they are naturally, they are used to hierarchical thinking, top-down thinking, you know. And the situation starts to spiral out of control from there. Now, that's just one scenario I want to put to you. And, I mean, I can think of lots more. You know, what happens if you're sharing power with a lot of, or not sharing power, but there's a sufficient number of Leninists who've actually got gathered a force together. Now, these sorts of things are possibilities. I don't think that they are questions that we can't answer, but we just don't think about them. We don't think about things when they go wrong. And I think that if we did, we would actually come across as less utopian. We would actually come across as somebody who's actually thought about the difficulties rather than wanting to give a really positive view. And so I'm in this sort of slightly contradictory position where I think we do need to give a positive view, but we need to give a positive view which is more nuanced and takes into consideration, you know, the difficulties, because things do go wrong in the world. You know, we just do know that. They don't go to plan. So I asked myself, why do I accept the socialist case? As I say, I'm a moderate skeptic, and these kind of questions that I ask myself from time to time, they haven't diminished my commitment to socialism, but they have changed the way I think about it quite a lot. Some arguments that I picked up from the party many years ago have strengthened in my mind. Some I've abandoned because I don't think that they're realistic. And I've had to shift a number into the I just don't know category. I had to ask myself, do I just accept the case on the moral argument and the speculative arguments alone and the theoretical arguments? You know, what proof do I have that socialism can work? And so I've had to think about that quite carefully and see if I can come up with anything. So kind of to wind up, these are slightly rambling thoughts, but I just thought that I'd wanted to share them with people here tonight. I think there are three reasons to pursue better, more hard-headed, and more positive but strategic arguments for socialism. And the first one is the obvious one. We need to be more convincing to other people and appear less utopian in our thinking. But I think there's a more personal one. I think we need to be more solid in our own foundations. Well, look, let me speak for myself. I need to be more solid in my own foundations. You may be perfectly happy with the foundations that you've laid down. But I think I need to be, and to ask myself, whoops, there goes my screen again. Okay. I think I certainly need to feel stronger in my convictions. Because unless I do, I'm not going to be convincing when I actually talk to people. More solid, the arguments I can present to myself, then the more a better propagandist I'm going to be. And there's a third thing, and we need more positive arguments to cheer ourselves up, really. I think we badly need it in this time. I am actually feeling very positive about anything, and I think socialists have good cause to feel a bit sort of low at the present time. But it's not useful. So, yeah, to cheer ourselves up. All right, thank you.